May it please the court. Good afternoon. My name is John Stevens, registration number 32115, and I represent the appellant in this case, Dr. David Kumpe. The appellant has raised five issues on appeal, but this case really comes down to one concept, and that's the concept of having the ability to have a fair trial. It's about justice. As advocates, we're tasked with protecting our system of justice, and in doing this, we're guided by principles of ethics and rules of professionalism. When we represent our clients, we have to remain true to those guiding canons. And that's probably why the term zealous has been removed before the preceding advocate, because when we stray from those principles, we no longer do justice. And that's the backdrop of this case. My client did not receive a fair trial in the underlying matter for the five reasons that we raised in our briefs. The first reason is that an improper instruction of comparative negligence was provided to the jury. Now, in this case, it involves a ski accident. My client was on skis. The defendant, the appellee, was on a snowboard. My client, in the underlying case, was hit from behind just over a rise at Copper Mountain Ski Resort. The appellee, the defendant in the underlying case, Mr. Shanahan, he struck my client from behind on a snowboard. That's my client's version of what happened. Very clear, very simple, very straightforward. Based on that collision, he suffered significant injuries to the left side of his body and also to his right shoulder. The reason that comparative negligence was improper to be provided to the jury as an instruction is that the defendant's story wasn't that I was cut off by the plaintiff or that the plaintiff was skiing erratically or anyway improper. Instead, what the defendant said is, yes, I saw the plaintiff and I passed him on the right and I passed him going to the left, and later down the hill, the plaintiff struck me. These are two separate and irreconcilable series of events. This isn't a comparative situation where there's one accident and in different versions of, well, I was going faster or slower. These are two separate events on the ski mountain. Because of that, there can't be comparative. There's one version that says I was hit in the back, which the plaintiff states, at one area of the ski hill, and then the defendant's version says he also was hit in the back at a different area on the ski hill. That's not a comparative liability situation, and it was improper for the judge to instruct or provide that instruction to the jury.
Stevens, you seem to assume that the jury was required to believe one or the other, but the jury could choose to make its own decision on what actually happened, couldn't it?
Well, they could, absolutely, Your Honor, but I think what was incorrect in this case was because you had two different versions of events, completely separate, there's no doubt about that. That's undisputed. That's not a comparative situation, though. Whether they believed one or the other, when you give them an incorrect instruction, and in this case, what's critical to understand is that this wasn't a case where all the weight went to one side or the other, or a vast majority of the weight. This case was really decided by credibility. Who are you going to believe as a jury? And because of that, when you have all the other things that went wrong in the trial, that, or we believe went wrong, you have to look at those factors and ultimately the instruction provided by the trial court. And the trial court gives that instruction, says, well, here's a comparative instruction. You can believe that, you know, whatever percentage you want to put into it. In this case, though, based on those facts, if the jury believes one or the other, you can't have a comparative situation.
Why can't the jury believe part of one and part of another?
Well, the way it was presented by the parties, Your Honor, it wasn't presented where they meshed at any point. It was the accident either happened one way, according to the plaintiff, or it happened completely another way. Experts were the same on each side. It wasn't a situation where it commingled in any sense.
I understand exactly what you're saying, but I mean, we tell juries all the time you can believe all, part, or none of a witness's testimony. So are you saying that because of the way the party structured the case, the jury was told you have to believe one or the other, you can't make a decision to the contrary, you have to believe one or the other?
No, Your Honor, what I'm saying is that the jury was not incorrect in however it came up with its conclusion. It's legally, the trial court, the judge should not have given that instruction to the jury because there was not evidence of a comparative situation legally. When you had the case presented that it was either one or the other. There was no argument from either side that it was a comparative situation. So it isn't a matter of what the jury believed. It's the instruction that was provided to the jury that's in error.
But your opponent asked for the instruction, didn't he?
Yes, Your Honor, he did. We objected to it.
Okay, so doesn't the fact that he asked for the instruction indicate his view that there was evidence of comparative negligence, and the trial court must have said, yeah, I think there's some evidence of comparative negligence?
Well, we can argue and present whatever we want in terms of argument, but when we look at what was presented, and again, not what the jury believed, but what was presented at that point, what our position is that there was no evidence of comparative negligence. Because even though that opposing counsel asked for that instruction, they presented no evidence of a comparative fault situation. Their case, the entire time was, no, we didn't hit you in the back at point A on the ski slope. We passed you, and you hit us in the back. And based on the undisputed injuries sustained by my client, it makes it impossible to believe a commingling of those events. And even though the opposing counsel asked for that instruction, they presented no evidence of a comparative situation. The closest they got was, they said, well, the injury may have occurred when my client fell on his skis. But to get to that point, you still have to get to the triggering event, which was how he was struck. How did that fall begin to fall on his ski? Because if he was still struck by the defendant, then the defendant's still at fault on that. So even though the defendant asked for that instruction, there was no evidence presented by the defendant of a comparative situation.
Then how can the verdict be explained? I mean, your view is the jury sitting there saw evidence of two stories that are mutually exclusive, and yet they came up with 50% negligence on each side. I mean, it seems to me that if your argument were correct, the jury would have said 100%, 0%, or 0%, 100%. But they found 50-50. To explain that.
And that's one of the problems that we ran into, or one of the criticisms that we had, Your Honor, one of the issues we brought up in our appeals, that the verdict doesn't make sense. Because ultimately, again, what it came down to is credibility of who you're going to believe. And when you're given an improper instruction, essentially they can throw up their hands and it's 10 o'clock at night, we want to leave. And that's another factor that went into this. It was nearly 10 o'clock at night when they came back with their verdict. In the first part of their verdict, there were two claims raised by the plaintiff, negligence and negligence per se. They delivered their verdict on negligence, and then the judge asked them, or actually I asked, where the verdict is for negligence per se. The jury said, we don't have one. We never were asked that. And that created another issue as part of this appeal. But because we think that was at 10 o'clock at night, essentially 9:30 at night, they just threw up their hands and didn't come to a resolution, and they had an out provided by an improper instruction provided by the court. And we can't explain that verdict, because when you have two situations that both sides did not present, that did not overlap, it has to be one or the other.
Well, but factually, in terms of what happened procedurally, when the jury came back the first time, they had already done the 50-50 thing on the negligence claim.
Yes.
So they didn't go back and then throw up their hands and say 50-50. They had already done that. All right, so how can you say that the time was somehow a factor in sending them back when they'd already made a decision that each participant was 50% negligent?
I'm saying that for the first verdict, that it was late, that they came back and said, we've had enough, essentially. Because when you look at the facts, again, it goes back not necessarily what the jury did, but the instruction that was provided to them that was incorrect. And when we got the first verdict, our position is that it was late at night, they didn't want to stay there anymore, and they had an out provided by an improper instruction, when none of the facts fit that instruction, none of the facts presented by either side. And then when they came back the second time on the negligence per se, and a touch on that issue in terms of error at the trial level, there was no comparative instruction provided with negligence per se. It was only provided and asked for on negligence, not on negligence per se. There was only one verdict form or one type of verdict provided on the negligence per se, and that was either the plaintiff wins or the defendant wins. There was no carrying instruction or anything else like that. When the jury came back was instructed to go back on the negligence per se claim, within a few minutes their first question is, what is negligence per se? Which indicated clearly they had not gone through the jury instructions, because the definition was provided in the jury instructions. They came back 16 minutes later with both verdict forms filled out, saying both sides went on negligence per se, which indicates to us again that the verdicts are, you can't make sense of them. It seemed more likely than not that the jury simply threw up their hands and said, we want to leave because it's 10 o'clock at night. And they applied comparative negligence principles to the negligence per se, essentially by saying, well, we'll just take our verdict from the first one and apply it to the second one, even though there was no instruction provided for the negligence per se claim.
But why can't both parties have been negligent per se? So why doesn't comparative negligence apply to negligence per se?
Because there's no instruction for it and there's no request for it. And under the Collins Key Safety Act, both parties cannot be negligent per se because there's a specific definition that states that one skier must be the uphill skier.
Oh, but that's only one aspect of negligence per se. There's like eight of them.
Yes, sir.
So one skier can be the uphill skier and another skier could have been skiing out of control or meet one of the other seven factors. They're both negligent per se. The jury doesn't have to pick between them. It can decide they're both negligent per se.
And I would agree if there was any evidence of that, but there was no evidence that my client skied excessively fast or erratically or in any way improper. So when you look at the Colorado Ski Safety Act to fit all those criteria, yes, if one is the uphill skier, then the other, the downhill skier, must have been skiing in some irresponsible way.
Why couldn't the jury, well, you have two parties saying the other was the uphill skier.
Yes.
Why couldn't the jury say neither one of you was? You went like that.
Because there's no evidence of that. You know?
Well,
I mean, I would agree with you if there was evidence of that, but in this case,
the jury can say, look, their perceptions may have been off. They do have evidence of the other circumstances surrounding the skiing, you know, where they were coming from, the directions they were coming from, and how fast relatively they were going, or so they said, what kind of terrain it was, all these things. The jury can factor in all those things and decide, you're equally at fault.
And then in that case, it undermines the whole trial system of what we present as evidence. If there's no evidence presented of that situation you provided, then what's the whole process all about? Because there was no evidence of improper skiing. Even if we take into consideration all the terrain, if the jury said, well, we're going to make up our own minds, but there's no evidence presented of that, and there's no claim of that made. And so that is problematic again when we look at the verdict, because then what we're trying to do is ad hoc explain a verdict based on no evidence that was presented and trying to guess then what's in the minds of the jurors of what happened as opposed to what was actually presented at trial. And that's what we're looking at here on the appeal, what was actually presented. There's no conflict between both sides in terms of their stories. They never meet in the middle on that. And briefly, in terms of the other issues, they go to the same idea about not receiving a fair trial. The one thing that I want to touch on quickly is that this claim about the mistrial with the defendant claiming that he potentially would have lost his career. We believe that the trial court was in error on that, and that when you look at the entire record, it's replete with intentional violations of the court's order. Even in the answer brief, the defendant does not deny that they violated the court's order, basically saying, well, they in fact raised new facts about, well, he had a concussion, he had this fear, where it was never disclosed. This wasn't a typical client that someone picked up off the street. This was the attorney's son. Clearly, they knew what they were going to talk about at trial. And there was a deliberate attempt to raise this issue. Again, it goes back to the idea, this is about credibility between the parties. Increasing or trying to increase some type of improper sympathy or other motive, and saying that even though he was precluded specifically and promised to the court that he would not violate that court's order about the head injury, does it anyway. That goes back to the entire issue of what's fair and receiving a fair trial. I have about a minute 20 left, and I'd like to reserve that for rebuttal. Thank you.
If it pleases the court, I'm Steve Shanahan. My attorney registration number is 14893. I represent Patrick Shanahan, my son, who is a captain in the Air Force. The plaintiff was Dr. Kumpy. I want to get straight to the idea of comparative negligence and affirm for you that while each party vigorously argued that the other party hit them from behind, there was evidence that the jury could use to conclude that both of them were negligent. The case of Gordon versus Benson says the failure of a party to present evidence of his own negligence or to argue that he was negligent does not result in abandonment of comparative negligence defense. Let me give you several obvious reasons why this jury of Summit County jurors, all experienced skiers themselves, one lady's husband was head of the ski patrol at Keystone. These are this is the kind of jury you really want for a case like this. Captain Shanahan said that what he happened was he saw the skier in front of him, Dr. Compey. He went to Dr. Compey's left while Dr. Compey proceeded to make a move and ski to the right. Captain Shanahan said, "I did not say," and when questioned, "Did you give the doctor a warning?" "No. I didn't feel it was necessary because we were moving apart." A jury could conclude that it believes he should have given a warning. A jury could conclude that Dr. Compey hit Captain Shanahan from behind, just as Captain Shanahan said it occurred, and yet hold Captain Shanahan responsible for not giving a warning. On your left, it's a common thing that we hear all the time if you're on the mountain. You want to let the person in front of you know, for your own safety, that you're going to be going by them. Also, you do it for their safety. A jury of this sophistication could easily say, we believe that both of them were negligent. The Colorado Ski Safety Act, as one of the seven different acts that it calls negligence per se, says that each part, every person, has the obligation, the duty, to keep a proper lookout at all times. Duty to keep a proper lookout at all times. The jury could easily say, you know, Captain Shanahan, we believe that he probably went by him. But they said they were both going at a moderate speed, and it's not hard to understand how a skier could catch up with a snowboarder in a short period of time and be basically parallel to one another. And yet they had an obligation to each other and to anyone else out there to keep a proper lookout at all times. The jury could find that. The argument, the cases say this all the time, and the instructions say to the jury, argument is not evidence. Both parties argued that they were the downhill skier. That the jury was not obligated to follow that argument to its logical conclusion that both of them were up the downhill skier. That's not what the jury did. And let's face it, the proof is in the pudding. This jury of sophisticated jurors in Summit County found comparative negligence, that each party was responsible in some measure, and they measured that at 50-50. Was it a good instruction? Yes, not from the plaintiff's standpoint, but was it a good instruction under these circumstances with these facts? Yes, it was. And it redounded to the plaintiff's displeasure, but the judge was right in doing it.
Shanahan, I've heard you say that there was evidence from which a jury could infer,
yes,
that a warning should have been given. Was there any other evidence about something about that was, I guess, negligence related that the parties disagreed about?
Well, there was a lot of disagreement about whether or not the injuries that were sustained could have been sustained in the way that Dr. Compey said that he sustained his rib injuries.
For example, I'm not sure if I'm going to be answering your question exactly right, so help me if I don't, but evidence showed that Captain Shanahan was downhill, directly downhill of Dr. Compey by 8 or 10 feet when they both came to rest. Evidence showed that Dr. Compey's son and Captain Shanahan's sister, who were skiing behind them both. Neither of them saw the collision itself, but they did see one thing. They saw Dr. Compey flailing and going down. They did not see Captain Shanahan because he was already on the ground. And so you have this situation where Dr. Compey says, I was hit from behind, and yet he turns out to be the uphill person and the only person who is seen falling while Captain Shanahan is already down. These things suggest, that Captain Shanahan was in fact the person who got hit first and knocked down, and that Dr. Pumpy was the uphill skier. I'm trying to answer your question. I think I've done that, but I'm not certain.
Counsel, I want to ask you about these verdict forms on the negligence per se.
Sure.
Because they are getting inconsistent. I mean, you can't hold in favor of both parties on the same claim. So, they're clearly inconsistent. Why shouldn't we just reverse for at least on that claim, at least on that claim?
You know, Your Honor, respectfully, I disagree with you. And the reason I say that is when you get to the meat and potatoes of what is the real effect here, and that is in the verdict form B, which is the common law negligence verdict form, you found that 50-50, and the jury instruction says to the jury, if you find that the plaintiff is at least has as much culpability or percentage of wrong or wrongdoing as the defendant, then, or has a greater percentage, then there is no award of damages. So the verdict form was filled out in an appropriate way. And the jury knew that the result was zero. They knew that. It's part of the standard instruction, stock instruction. They went to deliberate at about 4:35 o'clock, and oh, by the way, they were asked, would you like to come back tomorrow? And they said, no, we want to deliberate tonight. And they they weren't being forced to do that. And they deliberated till about 9:30. They came back, the verdict was read, and it was realized that verdict form C and D weren't there. The jury said, we never got them. The judge said, well, I gave them to you. And nobody has to be at fault. The judge said, well, would you go back? And they said, yes. And they did. And they came back 30 minutes later. All the hard lifting had been conducted. What did they say? And it, which is totally consistent. They said, once again, verdict form C, the defendant is negligent per se. Verdict form B, the plaintiff is negligent per se. Totally consistent with what they've done in B. They then said to themselves, well, it doesn't tell us, but it says, what are the damages? And previously we said the damages were $19,000 and some change. But we know that it's supposed to be zero, because that's what comparative negligence is about, and they wrote down zero. It is completely consistent. The bottom line results are both parties are negligent. The amount of award is zero. This is what the jury did. Now, the cases say that the court should harmonize and give voice to jury verdicts if it can find a reasonable basis for doing so. On the face of it, it might seem like they're inconsistent, but they are totally consistent in their bottom line results and in their findings. So we believe that that certainly is no reason for sending it back. It's an anomaly, but it's not inconsistent. The jury did its job in both sets of circumstances. Now, the plaintiff appellant has really seven issues, and so I'm going to race through some, but I guess I'd like to throw it out to the court and say, are there other issues or these same issues that you have questions about? Because I'm not sure I can get through seven more issues. And if you have something you'd like to ask me, I'd be happy to entertain it at this time, or maybe we'll just get started and go through them. Well, I'm going to try it. The plaintiff appellant has said that the defendant's expert, his testimony should have been stricken. And when you go to the actual transcript where they made the objection, they said, you know, look here. The expert has written here that he cannot say with certainty what exactly happened. Well, what expert wouldn't say that? And they all say that. And then he said, as all experts do,
However,
we do have some evidence. We don't have all the evidence we'd like, but we do have some evidence. It's this. And he went through all of this, and he took into account what Dr. Compey said, what his son said, what Captain Shanahan's sister said, what Captain Shanahan said, what the ski patrol people said, the measurements, everything. And he said, you know what? I do find that Captain Shanahan's version of events is consistent with the facts and with these facts specifically. And I do find that Dr. Compey's version of events is not consistent. Well, what the appellant wants to say is, if you once say, I can't tell you absolutely with certainty what happened, that everything after that cannot be, that's the end of it. You can't say anything more. They've gotten a little bit more sophisticated as they filed their briefs, and they said, you know, the words consistent and the word, the statement that it's more likely than not that Captain Shanahan's version of events occurred, and it's more likely than not that Dr. Compey's version of events did not occur that way, that this did not occur that way. That is really what is at the heart of this. They changed their tune, but let me just say, the words, it's consistent with, not consistent with, more likely, less likely, are words that are different, but they carry the same message. It's the same meaning. And if this court strikes down this witness and says, only if you give a qualified statement like that, then there's going to be, you're going to have a lot of appeals. It doesn't make sense. There's claims of attorney-client misconduct. And it's true that Captain Shanahan had a counterclaim. And he did suffer some injuries. Not much, I grant you. He did. He had a sore neck. This is shown on the patrol report. He had a bruised or sore chest. He had a bruise or soreness on the inside of his thigh, and this was all reported to the ski patrol. And, you know, it's not much, but it's an injury. And a jury could award money for that. But what happened was we did not make a sufficient disclosure of Captain Shanahan's other injury, which was for a very short period of time, an instant, when he was sitting on the ground shortly after the collision, he thought and had this fear, since he's a pilot, and he knows it doesn't take much to be disqualified from being a pilot. 90% of the, well, I'm going to go outside the record. And he had that fear. And the judge said, you didn't disclose it enough. And you should, and so I'm not going to let you talk about that. And we said, okay. And I talked with Captain Shanahan about that. In the trial, lo and behold, in response to a question, he said, I was afraid that my ability, my Air Force flying was over. No sooner had he said it than Mr. Stevens jumped up, objected, and said, no, that can't be. The upshot of all this, and I'm running out of time, so I'm going to be really quick on it, is that Captain Shanahan withdrew his claim. So now the testimony with regard to, you know, my injuries went away. He withdrew his claim. And the judge gave an instruction to the jury, admonished them not to consider it. The judge had a wonderful curative instruction. There's no prejudice here. This is not the criminal cases that they cite where the prosecutor leaves the charge there and the witness says something that they're not supposed to say. This is a civil case and the claim was withdrawn. Thank you. I appreciate your time. I wish I had just a little bit more for those other five objections.
just want to address real quickly this claim of other damages, and it goes along with how the case was presented from the defendant's perspective. The defendant stated unequivocally during the trial, I didn't have any type of head injury, so I wasn't concerned about this. So it's a fiction to come up with this idea after the fact, after they withdrew a claim that they stated we never really had any intention of asking for that, or it never meant anything, that there was really a claim there. That goes on this whole part about making sure that we adhere to our principles and our professional requirements. It's great that we can talk about, or the opposing counsel can talk about what the jury thought. The rest of us don't have that ability, but that's not the issue. We can't do anything about it once the jury has it in their mind. Our issue is the instruction that was given to the jury. That was incorrect. Whatever the jury thinks about it, we're stuck with that. But our appeal isn't on that. It's the instruction that was given to the jury on the comparative, and that was incorrect because there was no evidence of that at that time to give that instruction to the jury. In terms of the negligence per se, there was no instruction applying negligence per se to, or comparative negligence to the negligence per se. Defendant didn't ask for it, and there was no carrying instruction for that. Comparative negligence only applied to common law negligence. And with that, we'd ask that the findings of the trial court be reversed and remanded, and this be set for a new trial. Thank you.
Both your arguments this afternoon, this case will stand submitted. We'll issue a written opinion in due course.
Thank you.